Mark Maron. It's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives, sobbing lurking conservatives, I would assume. Good morning to all you well-to-do liberals and progressives out there that think that civil rights is how you treat your nanny and whether or not you pay her properly and let her onto your health care. I don't know, Mark Riley. I'm just trying to alienate everybody as quickly as I can in the morning, you know, because that's the way to go. That's the way to open up.
Wait a minute, man. It's kind of early for that, isn't it?
Sorry, you're right. You know what? I want to thank Penelope in Wyoming for the amazing the pre-Christmas gift packages. She made us all bowls with our names on it, or some form of a nickname. She sent us cereal for breakfast. She sent us spoons.
She even sent us a $5 bill to go out and buy milk with.
She gave us everything we need for a big boy breakfast.
Yeah.
Three kinds of cereal. We got peanut butter, Captain Crunch, and Fruity Pebbles, and some granola, and some
granola raw. It wasn't bad.
I'll tell you what a great fan she is. She has given us so much stuff. I wear her T-shirts. My entire apartment. I could have decorated my apartment with stuff that Penelope gave us. What are you looking at, Kalo? What's with the attitude this morning? Why can't you dress like the guy who's going to replace you? Put a tie on. Trent comes in. Yeah, the guy who's going to be filling
the
in for Chris Represso when he's on vacation.
Chris Represso.
While Chris takes a sobbing vacation in Seattle, wondering why he's not in Rome because he can't stay with a woman for more than 10 minutes before he's. You want to play games? Let's go.
The rain will hide the tears.
Exactly. But I think you might want to think about dressing up a little bit because I'm impressed. Right away, I know that he's probably better than you at doing your job.
That's working already.
Just by virtue of a tie. See how they trick you?
All right, that's cool, man.
No,
it's all right. You know what? You can do my job right now.
No.
What's up, Kalo?
Wait, you're just going to go get something to eat, right? Right? Where's he going?
No. Staten Island is where he's going.
Oh. He's going to go to Staten Island with his bowl? That's the saddest thing I've ever seen. He's got the bowl Penelope made him, and he's just like walking to Staten Island. I'll go get cereal at my mom's house.
Oh, my God.
You know, I have to say that I had a moment of reflection today when we were sitting there before the show, right, where I was like, I can't even believe what is going on with the GOP. I can't even believe it. I mean, it is mind-blowing how much it has fallen apart on all levels. To the point where I'm watching my tone because I don't want to be so schadenfreude ridden. I don't want to be so happy that everything is breaking apart that I become contemptuous. But let me tell you something. I'm going to try and handle this in a delicate fashion, but they're going down and I can't even hide my excitement, but I'm going to try. All right. The assumption, first, let's start with Dick Cheney, can we?
Sure. Let's begin at the beginning.
Okay. The assumption that Scooter Libby and Stephen Hadley and Karl Rove and Judy Miller would all fall on stakes to protect Dick Cheney from indictment may be true. All right, that doesn't mean he'll avoid it. Though it may be unlikely, Special Prosecutor Fitzgerald must be looking to nail Cheney with almost definite indictments that are going to fall on Rove and Libby. It seems that Cheney has got a snitch on the inside, and that this snitch has given him information. He also questioned administration officials about Bush's complicity, but more importantly, he questioned former Cheney spokesperson Jennifer Miller-Wise, ex-White House aide Jim Wilkinson, and Cheney's communications advisor, Catherine Martin. That's along with Libby, along with Rove, along with Miller. So it seems to me that if he can prove that the vice president was an active participant in a decision to smear Joe Wilson, which I know he did it. How hard could it be to prove? Then he can nail him.
Well, what Fitzgerald seems to be doing now is looking at the large picture that was going on in the White House during the run-up to the war.
Yeah.
And what they're seeing is, A, it was Dick Cheney who was immediately activated, Dick Cheney and Scooter Libby, immediately activated by the rumor, not the fact, the rumor of Saddam Hussein looking to do business in Niger for some yellowcake uranium. It was his, you know, he got some kind of an intelligence briefing during one of his numerous trips to the CIA, and it said, wow, light bulb went off in his head. This is the smoking gun we've been looking for.
Yeah, okay. And then he tried to bully those guys over the CIA to do it, and then through these other channels, he had plain go. I mean, he was, I think...
Well, he had Wilson. See, Wilson was the net result of that initial curiosity, okay?
Right.
But then Wilson strayed off the ranch. He deviated from the script. And what Fitzgerald seems to be looking at now is exactly how Cheney reacted to that.
Right.
Exactly how Cheney reacted to the report that said the yellow cake situation was bogus, that the information was forged, that it had no validity whatsoever.
Right, but it's also, it becomes apparent, and we've talked about it on the show, that I didn't mean play him, I meant Wilson, was that because, you know, Cheney was over there bullying the CIA to get them the intelligence that he wanted to justify his movement towards war, that he put feelers out into the CIA that really resulted in Wilson going.
Wilson being sent in the
no
first
doubt.
Place. Absolutely. But see, now what Fitzgerald is starting to narrow down is Cheney's reaction to Wilson's report.
Which exactly is, we're going to get that bastard.
Yeah,
we're
now
do
they're
it.
Trying to figure out whether Cheney was an active participant. That's the important part here. Yeah. An active participant in what now he seems to have established was a plan to smear this guy.
Of course, and this is, it comes down to the question, how can he not have been an active participant? Libby's sitting in the next room. All these people are in the next room. What do you think, that he's not going to know? This guy is an evil genius. Him and Rove are the people that have been running the planet into the ground for the last 6 years or however long it's been. And the bottom line is that there's no way he couldn't have known. And I hope to God, I really do, if there is a God, I hope that Cheney goes down with this. This is the most amazing thing I've ever seen in my politically awake life, the way that the GOP is coming unhinged. And that's sort of be a theme of our show today. And dig this, according to a letter, this is DeLay now. Let's shift over to Tom DeLay, who is going to have to do the perp walk. He is going to have to be fingerprinted. He's going to be mugshotted. He may be cuffed. He's going to be brought down to the Texas County Jail, despite the attempts of his attorneys to bypass the mugshots and fingerprinting. He will actually not do jail time because of a bond agreement. So, but the bottom line is, please, if anyone's going to get those pictures, if you've got the mugshots of Tom DeLay, I just want to put a feeler out there. I know we got friends in Texas. I know we got listeners in Austin. I know that there are people in that state that can get this for me. I want the mugshots, man, for a T-shirt. Again, don't want to see. I'm reveling too much. Let's talk. But this is an interesting fact that apparently, Riley, according to a letter sent by DeLay's attorneys to the office of the Texas State Prosecutor, DeLay was offered a deal to plead guilty of a misdemeanor violation of election law, as opposed to being indicted on a felony criminal conspiracy or a felony of criminal conspiracy or money laundering, which required him to step down. He turned it down because he was too proud.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because he could have held on to his House Majority Leadership had he taken the deal. But now you're seeing his lawyers, you know, you saw last week, Mark, when his lawyer tried to subpoena Ronnie Earl to testify about his dealings with the grand jury. They are truly grasping at straws. You know what they're saying now? They're saying that $190,000 check was perfectly legal because it was not funds. And the law in Texas prohibits the money laundering of funds. So they're saying this check was not funds. Now, if you're not talking about splitting hairs as far as how he's trying to weasel out, they're trying to quash the indictment based on that.
Well, he's got two indictments, which means that he can't quash both of them. And he's being desperate. He's buying ad space to slander Ronnie Earl. He's running around with all this pomp and circumstance. But I'll tell you, if we can judge by what's going on in the House in terms of the power struggle that's going on there in his absence and just the mistakes he has made, you know, over the last couple of years, that is as sort of there's a lot of festering resentment on the behalf of a group of fiscal conservatives towards DeLay and towards the actions of this Congress that they are starting to take over in the void of his absence. We're going to talk about that in a few minutes because it's fascinating, and I can't even pretend to know a lot about it, but I have been doing my reading, and I think I understand. I think between Riley and I, we can probably provide you with a pretty well-rounded picture of how the GOP is eating itself. And we'll start by telling you that their big idea now is they're giving Harriet Myers a makeover. And we're going to get into that in a second. It's 15 past the hour. You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on the air and online. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
We'll All right, it's 20 past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
Dare America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Hey, folks, if you're up and you're awake and you're in the Bay Area, I will be at the Osher Marin County JCC in San Rafael, California this Saturday night at 8 p.m. For tickets, go to marinjcc.org. Now, the general message we can assume, Riley, coming out of Washington, out of the White House, is things just don't run as smoothly when Carl isn't around. I mean, Karl Rove is preoccupied entirely with putting together a defense, I'm sure at this point, against a certain indictment from Patrick Fitzgerald's grand jury. Now, what we're seeing now is a desperate attempt, without Carl having his hands on this, it seems, a desperate attempt to remake Harriet Myers as a legal whiz of some kind. Bush is desperately trying to counter the criticism from fiscal conservatives who are pissed at him for a whole bunch of big spending problems, but the nomination of a nobody after they've waited for years for this opening, for this opportunity to make this court conservative, and he puts this woman up as just push them over the edge. But Bush has taken a couple of actions to remedy this.
Well, yeah, he's taken a couple of actions in that, on the one hand, he is sending some not-so-subtle hints out of New Hampshire, which is, of course, where all the 2008 Republican hopefuls must pass through, that anyone who wants to be president in 08 and expects any backing at all from the Bush money people had best get on board with Myers.
So they got this guy, Tom Rath, a New Hampshire lawyer. He's a member of the RNC, and he's basically having this guy call senators saying, if you don't do the right thing with Myers' vote, we're cutting you loose. Now, my question is, Riley, at this point, that might actually be a good thing.
Well, you know, I'm not so sure that these folks really want to be Velcro to George W. Bush's anchor at this point, but they do like the money that Bush's friends raise for him.
Right.
That part they do like. And that money is doled out by, guess who, the Republican National Committee, Ken Melman, Bush's boy, chairman. So that money, that spigot can get turned off in terms of people, particularly trying to go through New Hampshire, because that's a very crucial state in terms of the primary up there in 08, and that's where sometimes presidencies are made or broken. So there's a really not-so-subtle message coming out of there. But I got to tell you, people ought to be outraged. They ought to be outraged that this administration has the temerity to market this woman one way, and then when that doesn't work, market her another. But what's next? Harriet Myers as the defender of states' rights if people don't like her as a legal whiz?
But it's weird because the information that's coming out of them that they're trying to spin is no different than the information we had before. What they're just doing is they're just de-evangelicanizing her. They're taking out the religion out of the presentation, and they're basically just going with what they went before. You know, it's just like that she was a corporate practice, a history of corporate law, a couple of states board appointments. The real problem is, Riley, am I wrong in saying that the real problem is they're afraid about what Sam Brownback of Kansas, the theocrat out of Kansas, they're afraid what he will do because he is a Republican on the Judiciary Committee.
Yeah.
And if they lose one of those votes, this is sunk for them.
Yeah, this is done in committee. It won't even get to the floor unless he takes some kind of extraordinary action, and I'm not even quite sure what that would be. Myers is in deep trouble, like we were saying, for the last couple of weeks, and at this point, they are trying this latest strategy as a last-ditch effort to try and get her through committee. I mean, the hearings are due to start the second or third week in November. They're going to be really, really closely watched now because of this conservative backlash toward this woman. The Democrats have been content to sit on the side because the downside for them is that Myers goes down and Bush nominates somebody worse.
Yeah, and also the interesting thing about this is with Karl Rove out of the picture or seemingly at least handicapped or disabled a bit, it's incredible just how much they don't have a plan, how there is no narrative backing this nomination in the public eye, to the point where they've actually enlisted the help of Newt Gingrich to revamp the talking points around Harriet Myers and how to present her. And apparently in the next few weeks or the few days or leading up to the nomination process, if this whole thing doesn't crap out the next week or two, they're just going to saturate the airwaves with stooge testimonials, talking Myers up in endorsements and op-eds. And it's not going to be enough because who are they going to try and convince? It's not really about convincing the American public. It's about convincing the senators who are going to be voting for her, right?
Well, it is about convincing particularly the senators on the Judiciary Committee, and she's been making the rounds. else. But there have even been disagreements, for example, about her views in terms of right to privacy, which is the foundation for Roe v. Wade. She had a meeting with Arlen Specter. Specter comes out of the meeting saying one thing. The White House says Specter was misinformed or misinterpreted what Harriet Meyer said. This is not a great beginning to a second rollout.
It's chaos. It's chaos. And the bottom line is, like anything else, like any frame, they set a frame. The frame they tried was bad. It was faulty. They tried to get a rally going on the base, on the religious fanatic base, and they tried to sort of push her off on regular conservatives who wouldn't have it, and that was the frame they chose. Now they're trying to reframe it, and the die is cast already, Riley. I got to assume that this woman, that this nomination is doomed, and on some level, you know, I'm frightened for what will come next, but on another level, I'm looking forward to the nomination process.
Well, what comes next is going to be a function of all the rest of this crap.
Yeah.
What comes next is going to be a function of how soon, or if at all, Karl Rove is indicted. It is also going to be a question of, because Republicans inside the White House have admitted that Andy Card's faction, who've been responsible for the marketing of Harriet Myers, quote, fumbled the ball, because the perception of a Supreme Court nominee is cast usually in the first 48 hours after they've been publicly nominated.
Right. So what, it's interesting, though, that they're going to blame Andy Card. That in terms of, like, you know, Andy Card and Karl Rove have this, you know, this problem. They have this problem. They're fighting for power within the ranks of the inner office there of the White House, and they're fighting for power for the futures of their careers. And Rove is disadvantaged right now, thank God. But it's just interesting that all of a sudden Rove is able to do one thing somehow or another, is make sure that Andy Card gets blamed for the failure of this.
Well, yeah, and see, Rove is not too busy to smear somebody
down the hall.
He may be talking to his mouthpiece, but he'll take a break when it comes to assessing blame as far as this thing's concerned, because it has been a debacle for the Republicans. The last thing in the world any of these guys expected was, you know, a fight from within. The George Wills, the Rush Limbaughs, the Charles Krauthammers, the Peggy Noonans, this conservative pundit pantheon has all turned on Harriet Myers, and they don't know why.
Yeah. Well, they don't know why. Well, let's figure out why. Because, Riley, I mean, I want you to help me out, and we're going to talk about the real difference between this conservative government and old school conservative, fiscal conservatives versus the neocon agenda.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that the fiscal conservatives are starting to say, all right, enough of this crap. You know, the country's bankrupt. These guys are criminals, and someone's going to have to take charge.
Yep.
And we're going to talk about that in a minute. We got the iNews coming up. We got some news out of Iraq. Stay with us. It's 27 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Thirty-four past the hour. Good morning, folks. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hey.
Hey, you know, it's coming unhinged, folks. It's coming unhinged for the GOP in a big way on all levels. But before we get into that specifically, let's talk a little bit about this. Yesterday, in Iraq, the electoral an Iraqi's electoral commission said it intended to audit quote unusually high end quote numbers and results coming from most provinces in the election for the passing of a constitution that took place on Saturday. The statement came after a Sunni Arab lawmaker claimed fraud in very contested regions at the hands of pro-constitution Shiites. This charge is shared among many Sunnis. The commission said it would take random samples from some ballot boxes to check the results. You know, Karen Hughes is there. Maybe she could help out.
Oh, yeah, right.
Do it Bush style. Apparently, Iraqi election officials said that here's the apparently totals in 12 Shiite and Kurdish provinces were as many as 99% of the votes were in favor of the Constitution. There are only 18 Iraqi provinces, and that just seems a little crazy.
Well, yeah, it seems a little crazy, and particularly two disputed provinces that are thought to have a Sunni majority, thought because, of course, there's not been an accurate census taken in Iraq in the past 15 years, but thought to have Sunni majorities, had yes votes on the Constitution of 70% each. So somebody's saying maybe somebody stuffed the ballot box. There are allegations that some members of the Iraqi police were seen taking ballot boxes and doing God knows what with them. So there are these allegations of corruption, much of it, of course, coming from the Sunnis themselves, So there's a question as to, you know, how valid all of these claims are, but they certainly have to go back now and look and see whether or not the fraud, you know, that they can find is enough to overturn the results of the election.
You know, sometimes, folks, when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. So luckily, we have an iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator. Let's crank it up and feed it some headlines, folks. All right, here we go from the Associated Press. Rice, I don't want to run for president. Rice, I don't want to run for president. Translation, America not ready for anti-black, black president. From Associated Press, intelligent design advocate testifies. Intelligent design advocate testifies. Translation, evolution fails to explain stupidity of some people. From Hollywood Reporter, Stallone getting back in the ring for sixth Rocky. Stallone getting back in ring for sixth Rocky. Translation, Rocky 6 will double as Cocoon 3. Rocky 6, Stallone to battle Kirk Douglas. New Rocky catchphrase, I've fallen and I can't get up. Did I just do an I've fallen and I can't get up joke? All right, look. Let's get into this somehow or another. I'm trying to wrap my brain around this difference between how fiscal conservatives, old school fiscal conservatives, states' rights people, big, small budget, small government people, compare to the type of conservatism that the neocons practice. Now, I think the good place to start is that there was the American Conservative magazine tears the neocon death cult a new one in its attack on the Iraq debacle, calling the coalition provisional authority of Paul Bremer the most corrupt administration in history that set the standards for much of what we're seeing today. I'd also like to talk about Iraq in the terms of something Naomi Klein, who is a columnist for the writer, a journalist, a reporter for the Nation, calls disaster capitalism. Quote, it is the rise of a predatory form of disaster capitalism that uses desperation and fear created by catastrophe to engage in radical social and economic engineering. The reconstruction industry works so quickly and efficiently that the privatizations and land grabs are usually locked in before the local population knows what hit them. Now, that's if it works well. What happened in Iraq is much different, and this article in the American Conservative magazine is just mind-blowing. I mean, to really understand how exactly the neocon death cult economic policy works, it's pretty basic. In Iraq, you break something into a million pieces under false pretenses, then launder the U.S. government's money, taxpayer money, and the billions laying around in Iraq through the pain and tragedy of the broken into the pockets of corrupt officials, both American and Iraqi, and into the pockets of contractors who are hired through questionable contracts, if any, to do work that may never even begin. It's economic cut and run. It's like strip mining that capitalizes on the pain, death, and destruction of a country and its people. Now, the destruction, like, this even applies to Katrina, but let's not go there.
Do you understand? Why not?
Because, well, we can.
I mean, it's the same thing.
Absolutely the same thing.
It's
urban renewal.
Sort of.
But the weird thing about Iraq that I learned from this article is that just how much of this money is missing and how much these guys went in there and just pillaged the place with their Iraqi counterparts. There are some officials in Iraq from Alawi's government that split with like $500 million. And they're right now, at least $20 billion belonging to the Iraqi people was wasted, along with hundreds of millions of U.S. taxpayer dollars. This is what your kids are dying for. This is what American soldiers are dying for. So this neocon death cult can get in there and cut and run on an economic level. Because you know that report we had last week, Riley, where it was talking about how security problems are at the core of why, you know, contractors can't do their work or overcharge. Well, that turns out to be probably a lie. That's part of the game. Apparently bribery and just pillaging in terms of like just taking money, not doing the work, splitting, to the point where like local Iraqis call some of these contractors Alibabas.
God,
yeah, because of their ability to manifest money where there was none. It's not even a racial derogatory slang. It's literally referring to the real Alibaba.
Well, you know, the amount of fraud and waste that went on over there is truly, truly mind-boggling. As you point out, $20 billion that the Coalition Provisional Authority, which, by the way, only lasted 15 months, they managed to mess up $20 billion, most of it in cash, in just over a year. They also managed, through a decision that they made, managed to allow about $4 billion from illegal oil exports. We also know that the government that succeeded the Coalition Provisional Authority, that government of Iyad Alawi, has arrest warrants out for some of its top people to the tune of another $1 billion. Add that up, that's $25 billion.
$1.6 million bricks of $100 bills were floating around. Things were being, duffel bags full of money were taken. Halliburton has a no-bid contract with the Army Corps of Engineers that's estimated to be worth $10 billion. Yep. Halliburton is frequently questioned over its poor record keeping and claims of overcharging. All right, in one instance, the company charged the Army more than $27 million to transport $82,000 worth of fuel from Kuwait to Iraq. In another example, it's accused of billing the Army for 42,000 daily meals for soldiers, even though it only served 14,000. And this is the environment or the air of corruption that goes on all levels. Halliburton, that's an easy target, but you know, I had no idea that Halliburton subsidiary Kellogg Brown Root has been around since Vietnam, where they were brought into question in terms of the same type of pillaging they did there. This is where this stuff is developed. This is how military contractors and the military industrial complex makes money off, you know, rebuilding and destroying at the same time, simultaneously. The military comes in and destroys, military contractors come in and rebuild. This is old-timey stuff. This is Vietnam stuff, but now it's taken to a whole new level.
This isn't just Vietnam stuff. This is organized. This is exactly how organized crime works. Untraceable cash, huge sums of untraceable cash. You're talking about pallets containing $1.6 million each in $100 bills. It went, no one knows where any of this is. And at the same time, this is all going on. And by the way, flying under the radar, we have on the flip side, the U.S. Congress, particularly conservatives in the House of Representatives, talking about having to make cuts on the backs of poor and working people to make up the money that's going to be spent on Katrina. So we have waste and fraud 6,000 miles from here, and here we have cuts to the poor.
Yeah, and that's interesting because those cuts to the poor were mobilized by these fiscal conservatives. And that's it. Like, we should have that discussion in just a couple minutes because it's a little nuanced and I want you to help me through it, Riley.
Sure.
But I do want to slander, and not even slander, I do want to throw a couple more facts out there about what is going on in Iraq. You have another company. This is not Halliburton. Custer Battles has an estimated $11 million contract to supply security at Baghdad International Airport. The company had never provided airport security before receiving the complex. Contract. It also received a $21 million no-bid contract to provide security for the exchange of Iraqi currency. It's alleged that much of the currency replaced by Custer Battles has never been accounted for. Two former company managers turned whistleblowers have charged that the company defrauded the U.S. government of at least $50 million. These are individuals. These are friends of the administration. These no-bid contracts were given out with any competitive, jockeying by other countries or even determining whether who could do the job or would do the job better or worse. They were given out to people who played ball. Apparently, Paul Bremer's provisional government that only lasted a short time just brought in all kinds of kids who were, you know, submitting their websites to the Heritage Foundation website, or submitting their resumes to the Heritage Foundation website in order to get these jobs overseeing billions of dollars. And they had no other intention. Bremer was put there specifically to funnel money out of Iraq into the pockets of crony contractors and people who are on the dole in Iraq. And that money, hundreds of millions of it, came from taxpayers' money. And these are the people that are supplying their sons and daughters to fight this conflict over what? Now it just seems that they're staying in there, you know, out of pride. They've already economically cut and run the whole damn place. And now the talk of them funneling money into Kurds and Shiite militias that are within the security forces, as opposed to creating a national force to protect future interests in how the oil layout is going to be after all this crap hits the fan with the Constitution and the government, how they are hedging their bets by not actually doing what they say they're doing, which is providing money and support to create a national Iraqi security force. What they're doing, we read about this last week, is they're funneling money. This is just talk. They're funneling money into Kurdish militias and Shiite militias to protect oil interests in the future. That means that they're regionalizing and splitting the country up already, guaranteeing a sort of civil war between those two factions and the malcontent Sunnis who have been marginalized.
Well, the Sunnis have been marginalized, and they fear that they will get no revenue from the oil, which is generally located in the south, which is the province of the Shia.
And dig this, and then we're going to talk about the, in a second, that we're going to talk about the House and this cutting, that the way that they're going to, you know, rebuild after Katrina is by taking money from the poor, you know, and this is real stuff. This, I'm not using the poor metaphorically. This is Medicare. This is food stamps. They're taking away farm support stuff. But, you know, closing up on this in Iraq is that this is how neocon financial policy works. This is how the World Bank's works. This is Wolfowitz's plan. This is Cheney's plan. This was always the plan. These guys have economically cut and run. They don't care. Look, if Cheney gets indicted, if, you know, if he goes down, who cares? He made Halliburton $10 billion, this year. Do you think that, that he doesn't have some part in that? These guys have made fortunes that will last generations. You know, Cheney's gonna be on currency, you know, in the year 2070. You know what I mean? These the fortunes that have been made by just little people out there in the world, contractors who are on the dole, are going to put their great-grandchildren through college. And this is on the backs of American soldiers being killed almost on a daily basis and on the backs of a type of destruction that the world may never recover from. Just remember, these are your elected officials, supposedly elected officials, and it is no... There's no reason not to celebrate the coming unglued of the GOP and the revelation of how they really do business. And we'll talk about fiscal conservatism in a minute because they're really no better. They just do it old style. 47 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
It's 52 past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. We're going to have the Cliff Notes in just a couple of minutes, but we are now trying to suss out or whatever you do, the difference between fiscal conservatism, neocon conservatism, big government conservatism, as the fiscal conservatives accuse the neocons of being. Beginning this week, Republican lawmakers will take steps to cut $50 billion from the 2006 budget. In the face of rebuilding after Katrina, where do you think this money will come from? That's right, folks. Programs to help the poor. Medicare, food stamps, farm supports. This is how old school Republicans do it. The difference between the neocon mentality and the fiscal conservative is basically the neocons under Cheney's rule believe that deficits don't matter. It's not their problem. Let future generations be saddled with that crap. They'll be gone soon, and they will have made out like bandits. The old school fiscal conservatives believe that irresponsible spending on behalf of the government, even if it's going into the pockets of friends of the GOP, is big government spending. The old guard wants to cut government spending no matter what. One seeks to capitalize on the pain of the poor at the expense of the government. The other seeks to cause pain to eliminate government spending. Both of them suck. Yeah.
Well, yeah, they both suck. But see, here's what the conservatives have been waiting for.
Yeah.
Okay. Actually, they've been waiting for Katrina because Katrina gave them the excuse they needed. They have had an under the radar problem with federal spending under George W. Bush. It's grown from 1.86 trillion to 2.47 trillion. Over the last 5 years.
So you're talking about, let's try to make a distinction because there is sort of a mild civil war going on in the GOP House. You're talking about fiscal Republicans were waiting for the opportunity to call out George Bush and his cronies on overspending through the government.
Well, yeah, and saying essentially we are going to have to make cuts. Now, part of the reason why they have to make those cuts is that the other part of their agenda also involves cutting. For example, getting rid of the estate tax, which is going to cost several billion dollars. Some of the other initiatives that they have that will end up putting more money in the pockets of the wealthy will also take money out of the pockets of the federal government. How do you resolve that? Well, if you don't want to look to trying to find the money in Iraq or trying to perhaps get rid of $24 billion out of a bloated highway bill, the way you do it is on the backs of the poor. You cut Medicare. You cut or try to hold the line on Social Security. You cut the money that is supposed to go to rebuilding in the wake of Hurricane Katrina.
Well, isn't that fascinating that they had an opportunity here? This is what blows me away, is that, first of all, the poor have no voice in this country. They don't have a voice
anymore.
Not
in the Republican Party, that's
yeah,
for sure.
But I got to be honest with you, barely in the Democratic
Party.
Yeah,
you're right.
You know, the bottom line is that, you know, most people, most middle-class people, you know, think that they're better off because they have credit in the house, all right? And the bottom line is nobody is that far away from being poor. And I guess until that reality becomes clear because of Republican legislation around bankruptcy and malpractice and a couple of other things, that, you know, people who think they're middle class are only, you know, one chronic ailment away from being broke, or one disaster, one hurricane away from being broke. And those people have no one to speak for them. So these people, the fiscal conservatives, they don't care. They're just going to push those people aside. And the thing that really irritates me the most is that in the results of Katrina, they had an opportunity to utilize the people who live there to rebuild that city, to start giving people jobs, to giving handing out, to letting contractors hire people there. But when they took out Davis-Bacon Act, and they that enabled them to not pay people minimum wage comparatively, and when they suspended affirmative action hiring policies, they basically just said, we're not going to let any of the people that lived here, you know, even have a shot at rebuilding their city. We're going to hire it out to people that are desperately poor, that probably don't even have a driver's license.
Well, see, the other thing that's going on here in this war between the neoconservatives and the fiscal conservatives is the role of Tom DeLay, because it's changed quietly. DeLay, just a few weeks ago, was saying to people, look, you know, we don't need to have budget cuts to pay for the cost of the hurricane relief. And then he turns around on September 13th, and by the way, saying essentially the same thing. If lawmakers had suggestions for cuts, he'd listen, but he wasn't offering anything up on his own, right?
Yeah.
And then you find just 3 weeks later, talking to the House Republican Conference in a closed-door meeting, and he's saying, I failed you. You guys filled a void in the leadership. That's called getting out in front of the wave.
Right, but he got called out by this group of fiscal conservatives, saying that where the hell do you think the money's going to come from? You guys can't keep borrowing money. You know, wait. You know, at some point someone's going to have to take responsibility. And unfortunately, to them, that looks like making these cuts in social programs that help the poor.
Remember this.
Yeah,
they always wanted to make these cuts to the to programs.
Right.
That, I mean, this is their meatball fastball down the middle pitch in this done.
But now that what the price they're going to have to pay is whether or not how they're going to look for the 2006 midterm elections.
Bingo.
So we got to get more into this, because there's some dirty dealings in how Bush is pushing the responsibility of rebuilding onto the states. We have Cliff Notes coming up, and obviously we're worked up. We got more. 57 past Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Blah, blah, blah.
All right, it's 6 past the hour. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. What do you keep doing with that button, Riley?
Well, because usually Chris activates it from in the other room, but he hasn't been doing that. I've had to do it.
We're getting the hang of this new studio. Just every once in a while, I'll see Riley go, hi! And there'll be nothing coming out, and it'll look like, what happened again?
Yeah, but it's on now.
Right.
It's cool.
I hear you, man. Hey, look, Saturday night, if you're in the Bay Area, I will be at the Osher Marin County JCC in San Rafael, California. That's at 8 p.m. For tickets, go to marinjcc.org. If you want to see me intellectually noodle for an hour, it'll be an improvisational adventure through my mind. How's that sound? Like, you don't get that every morning. I'm not knocking me. Go see me if you can. Look, we've got a couple of interesting guests coming up. The reason they're interesting is that they are going to be just guilty pleasure guests, I think is what you would call them. We've got Jill Brook from Travel Savvy Magazine. He's going to tell us where the top six or so hotels to have a romantic liaison are. She can tell us.
You'll be doing that one alone, Mary.
I want to travel, my friend, and I want to talk to her about travel. Frederick Kaufman, Harper Magazine's contributor here, an author. He's the author of an upcoming book, A Short History of the American Stomach, will tell us why watching the Food Network is like watching porn. I certainly know that one. It's exactly structurally the same. It's structurally the same. I'm excited to talk to him because, you know, I like talking about food. As a matter of fact, last night I made one of Mark Bittman's recipes, a guy who was in here with the Big Thousand Recipes, the world's greatest recipes. I made the miso marinated fish, my friends. Genius. Uh-oh. Genius. For those of you who are just tuning in, here are a few highlights of what we talked about on the program. It's time for today's Morning's Edition Cliff Notes. House GOP leaders are moving to cut $50 billion from the budget for things such as food stamps and health care for the poor. The slack created by the cuts can be picked up by private and faith-based organizations, you know, like mortuaries and coffin makers. The first thing they'll do is cut the poor. Not just programs for the poor, but the poor themselves. Congress is thinking of dropping them.
I love jokes like that.
New studies show that Department of Homeland Security has by far the lowest morale of any government agency. Just 4% said they were sure that creativity and innovation were rewarded, while the remaining 96% thought creativity and innovation were reasons to arrest people. Even more disturbingly, the number one reason that employees at the Homeland Security Department gave for their low morale was, quote, "We're all doomed." An Amish community in Minnesota is split on whether or not to get vaccinations in response to a polio outbreak. Outside communities aren't allowed to rush vaccine into the Amish community unless it's delivered by a man in a frock coat riding a crank-driven velocipede. Man. Oh. Some Amish have responded with new rules. No zippers or bright colors, no motorized vehicles, and no legs.
Oh, God.
Oh man.
Those were tasty jokes.
Hello.
Hey, let's indulge in a little liberal schadenfreude, but try to be respectful if possible. Someone actually wrote an email to me after I used that word once before, and she said, basically saying, "Hey, Mr. Smarty Pants, not everyone knows what schadenfreude is. Maybe you shouldn't throw around words like that because, you know, some of us people just, if there isn't a damn reason, everything you say, for some liberal to double-check themselves and ask themselves, like, wait, we have to be concerned with people that might not understand that. Maybe you should talk simpler. Look, it means, finding pleasure in other people's pain, basically. And let's segue from that, let's say this. Cheney might be going down, folks. The assumption that Scooter Libby and Stephen Hadley and Karl Rove would all fall on stakes to protect Dick Cheney from indictment in this in Patrick Fitzgerald's grand jury investigation is all well and good. That doesn't mean he'll avoid it. And there's some interesting news. There is news that that Fitzgerald has a snitch. There is a senior cooperating witness. This could get good, folks. All right. He has also questioned former Cheney spokesperson Jennifer Miller-Wise, ex-White House aide Jim Wilkinson, and Cheney's communications advisor, Catherine Martin. So, look, it's not just Libby, Rove, and Miller, my friends. This investigation is broad. It's big. He's throwing a big net. It might be a big criminal conspiracy rap. He also questioned administration officials about Bush's complicity. All right, to make a case against Cheney, Fitzgerald would have to find, it'd be a conspiracy indictment. He would have to show the vice president was an active participant in the decision to smear Joe Wilson. Look, I know he did it. I mean, I can see it by just extrapolating from, news articles that are real. How hard could it be for him to prove?
Well, I'm going to tell you where the problem is. The relationship between Dick Cheney and Scooter Libby is such that if Libby was involved in all this, then Cheney would almost have to have been an active participant. They spend most of their working days together. Does anyone seriously think that Scooter Libby, unbeknownst to Dick Cheney, would go ahead and develop a plan with or without the rest of the members of the White House Iraq group to smear Joe Wilson, that Dick Cheney would know nothing about that?
Let's talk about the Iraq group for just a minute, because I think a lot of people might not be clear on what it is. The Iraq group was the marketing arm of the White House, whose purpose was to sell the 2003 invasion of Iraq to the public. The task force was set up in August 2002 by White House Chief of Staff Andrew Card and chaired by Karl Rove. Soon after the group was formed, the Bush administration rhetoric on Iraq escalated. Records and notes of the group's activities have been subpoenaed by Patrick Fitzgerald as part of the investigation into the leak of Valerie Plame's name, which is what we're talking about right now. In the group, you had Karl Rove, you had Andrew Card, you had Karen Hughes, you had Mary Matlin, James Wilkinson, who served as General Tommy Frank's Director of Strategic Communications. He is currently the Deputy National Security Advisor for Communications. You had Nicholas Calillo. He served as the President's Chief Legislative Liaison before becoming Citigroup's Senior Vice President for Global Government Affairs. His job was to basically sell the war to Congress. You had Condoleezza Rice. You had Stephen Hadley, the former Deputy National Security Advisor, who is currently National Security Advisor, and, of course, Scooter Libby. These were the people whose job it was to develop an effective propaganda campaign to dupe the public into believing that weapons of mass destruction were being produced by Iraq and justifying the neocon death cult's invasion of the region that had been planned since the mid-90s see Pax Americana documents.
Well, yeah, and what you have here is an administration, and we said this from, I believe, the day we went on the air here at Air America, an administration who had a one-track mind when it came to the future, not just of Iraq, but of the entire region. That was the whole neocon philosophy. As Iraq goes, so goes the rest of the Middle East. Israel's security would be secured, and Israel's future would be secured, and the rest of the countries, the, quote, rogue states in the region, places like Syria, would know that U.S. might could be used against them so they would fall in line. That was the thinking.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah, well, we see how it's been working out for them since then. It has created a cesspool. Awful. It has created a cesspool that has washed over virtually every initiative this administration has tried to project over the last 12 months, perhaps?
Yep. So bottom line, Cheney, not to outside the possible that he goes down with these indictments. And in a related note, speaking of Schadenfreude, according to a letter sent by DeLay's attorneys to the office of the Texas DeLays, maybe I should clear that up, Tom DeLay, the congressman from Texas. This is a letter sent to a state prosecutor. DeLay was offered a deal to plead guilty of a misdemeanor violation of election law, as opposed to being indicted on a felony, whether it was a criminal conspiracy or money laundering, I'm not clear, which would require him to step down, which he had to do. He turned it down, claiming that he was innocent. This guy's pride is monumental, because he just didn't want to be dirty at all, thinking that just the fact that there are two indictments against him, that he's going to get out from under this by slandering the prosecutor, by claiming this and that, little nuances. This guy is a filthy, dirty, corrupt little man, and he deserves to go down. Now, here's another great, joyous thing, is Tom DeLay will likely be booked into a Texas county jail this week. Despite the attempts of his attorneys to bypass the fingerprinting and mugshot part of the booking, he will have to do a perp walk of some kind. Apparently, because of his bail agreement, he is not going to have to do jail time right now, in terms of the overnight stay posting, in what is that? What do they call that? Waiting for bond to be posted?
Yeah, we have Judge Bob Perkins in Travis County saying he believes that if God was charged with a felony, he would have to go through the booking process, too.
And I would love to see those mugshots of God, and actually pictures of God being fingerprinted. If anyone has those, there's some, and I don't want to make fun of God, but, he has not always done the right thing.
Now, see, I'm moving out of the studio just in case he decides to light this place up.
And right? that is I'm talking general God. I'm not talking, Christian or Muslim or the Jewish God. I do get some flack sometimes, Riley, for being a little hard on believers. And look, I certainly am not against anyone's faith.
You're just irreligious yourself.
I just choose to go through life panicky, fear-ridden, full of anxiety and neediness, because I think that's more objective. I think that's more reasonable. And, the relationship that I would have to develop with a higher power seems draining to me. I mean, how can that not be codependent, me walking around going, I know, I screwed up again. All right, when we come back, we're not going anywhere. We'll be sitting right here, but we hope that you will stay, because this is a very interesting study that was done about the morale in departments and bureaus of the U.S. government. You'd be surprised, where the highest morale is and where the lowest morale is, and I was. So hang out for that. 16 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition on the air and online. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
21 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. I'm Mark Maron. It's Mark Riley.
Hi.
In just a few minutes, I heard from the execs here at Air America that we got to, we're not selling enough ad time, so we got to do a product placement minute in a few minutes. We'll get into that. We're also going to be talking to Jill Brook from Travel Savvy Magazine. If you don't mind, we're going to take a little vacation. Would that be okay? But not yet. Let's keep going. In a survey taken by the Office of Personal Management between August and December of 2004, 12% of the 10,000 employees who returned the questionnaire said they felt strongly that they were encouraged to come up with new and better ways to doing things. This is, guess what department this is? This is the Department of Homeland Security. Only 13%. 12% of the 10,000 employees felt that they were being encouraged to come up with new and better ways of doing things. That's very low. There's no creativity being inspired over there. 3% said they were confident that in their department, personal decisions were based on merits. Personnel decisions, I'm sorry, were based on merits. And 18% said they felt strongly that they were held accountable for achieving results. 4% felt that creativity and innovation are rewarded. These are incredibly low numbers on all accounts, Riley. And it's sort of, it's sad on some level, but it's also frightening.
Well, it's sad because, this is an agency that seems to still be searching for its center or its culture or something to bind these employees together. By the numbers that are given here, they haven't gotten there yet. And we're talking about now a stem to stern survey of government agencies. It only finished in the top half. It's Homeland Security now. In the top half of the 30 departments and agencies on one question, more than 56% agreed with the statement, the work I do is important. Other than that, they got nothing.
Exactly. It's sad and it's revealing. Let me just make sure you understand these numbers. 12% said they felt strongly that they were, quote, encouraged to come up with new and better ways of doing things. And that's only 12%. It's so small.
Mm-hmm.
And 3% were confident that their department personnel decisions were based on merit. So that there's, intrinsic sort of institutional cronyism going on, even in these sort of lower levels, in the lower echelons of this department. Fewer than 18% said they felt strongly that they were, quote, held accountable for achieving results. What are they doing over there? I mean, this is the Department
of Homeland Security. Sending out emails.
Yeah, but it's the Department of Homeland Security. 4% said they were sure that creativity and innovation are rewarded. This is horrendously low numbers, all right? Fewer than one quarter of Homeland Security employees said that they knew for sure how their work relates to the agency's goals and priorities. The responses to the questionnaire were less favorable than those of, like you said, all other departments and large agencies surveyed. Of the 30 cabinet departments and large independent agencies, the employees of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration,
NASA,
yes, and the National Science Foundation had the highest morale. I guess it helps when you're able to say, hey, it flies! Or if you can say, we found a cure. I mean, those things are inspirational.
Or we're fighting intelligent design.
Yeah. So, is that what they're doing?
No. Well, the National Science Foundation, it is science versus intelligent design.
Well, National Science Foundation, I hope there is still some merits to it. I don't know the nuances of that, but certainly there is a contingent within this country that would like to see that just teach God's work.
Oh, yeah.
Which is not science. But the sad thing is that when you have something like the Department of Homeland Security, which is now, overseeing FEMA, which is now has big responsibilities in guaranteeing some system of making us at least feel like we're defended and maybe even facilitating some of that, is that these are from employees, just regular people working there. They have no leadership. They have no guidance. They don't know if what they're doing is connected to anything. It sounds a little like here. But I guess it's not unusual in all corporate structures for that to be the case depending on what the leadership is like. And I guess Chertoff is not providing any vision.
Well, Chertoff is, I guess we could give him a little bit of slack about being new on the job. But what they didn't take into account was you had people coming from all these different agencies, from 22 different agencies, which means you had people coming from 22 different agency cultures. And it's very tough to merge all of that in one large overseeing department when you have people from the Coast Guard and FEMA and the Secret Service and the Customs Service and the TSA, the Transportation Security Administration. You got to make all of that fit fit and gel together. And maybe it's going to take a little bit more time, but it doesn't look as, you know, when you look at a patient's vital signs, okay, the vital signs of the Department of Homeland Security do not look good at all.
Yeah, and I think you're being a little giving, you know, which I think is good. But it seems to me that I thought that after Tom Ridge split as head of Homeland Security, because Tom Ridge basically oversaw just a money laundering operation, a pork delivery system. And I thought that, you know, maybe when Chertoff was in charge, you know, I didn't have faith in him, but it seemed that there was something pending that, you know, in bringing all these institutions and these departments together, that something really needed to happen. But we certainly saw with Michael Brown, you know, and his incompetence being placed at FEMA, and just the way that FEMA had been gutted because it was taken out of a cabinet level position, put in Homeland Security, that their priorities are screwed up, and that they may still just be a pork delivery system, and that maybe these employees are just sitting there wondering, what the hell are we doing here?
That may be a very good point. It may be that they don't know what they're doing because the people at the top don't know what
they're
doing.
That's right. In just a minute, we're gonna take a rest, and we're gonna talk about travel and about hotels and about sex, and we're also gonna be talking, product placement with the Product Placement Minute. So stay tuned for Jill Brook from Travel Savvy Magazine and the Product Placement Minute, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Thirty-four past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yo,
it's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. People out there, Bay Area, Mark Maron, who is me, will be at the Osher Marin County JCC in San Rafael, California, this Saturday night at 8 p.m. I'm not doing a specifically tribal show in relation to the Jewish tribe. It will be a broad-based show talking about many topics. So feel free to go to marinjcc.org for tickets. You can always email us here at the show, sedition@airamericaradio.com, for comments and whatever. Sometimes I read them. Sometimes you people get me very aggravated, and I'll actually address that personally to you and show you just how sad I am by writing back to you. So, folks, where does Uma Thurman go when she wants to get away from it all? We're going to find out, aren't we? What are the best hotels in New York to have an affair in? Our next guest is the editor-in-chief of Travel Savvy Magazine, and she joins us in the studio this morning. Good morning, Jill Brooks. We need a vacation.
Oh, doesn't everybody...
Did I say Brooks? Sorry, Brooke.
Brooke.
It's okay.
Good morning.
Good morning, guys. Well, the whole point of this magazine, it's about list.
Uh-huh.
And the whole concept is that we're not taking you from place to place, but from experience to experience, because that's really what we want in a vacation.
I think that sounds like a good idea. And I swear to God, you know, given this morning and the amount of excitement and hostility I feel towards the Republicans in general, I need a little break right now. You're providing me with a vacation just by being here for this segment.
Yes, we want to thank you for that.
It's my pleasure. I love to give pleasure to people.
Wow, that's great. Great. I'm not,
as well as inspiration, though, because what happens is we get so overwhelmed by how many options there are out there that we get paralyzed. Like, what am I going to do? Where am I going to go? And we have such rationed time anyway, because let's face it, this job, my job, they don't give you enough vacation time. So you want to really use your power of choice correctly.
Right. Intensify and amplify the vacation experience.
That sounds great.
Yeah. And because I was looking at the book and I saw, you know, I got to be honest with you, when I saw where Uma Thurman went on her vacation, I was annoyed.
Well, you were annoyed because the whole thing is, if you read Us Magazine or People Magazine, she's always on a beach in those really skimpy bikini anyway, so she doesn't need a beach vacation. She's always at the beach.
Tell us where she went. I just want the people to know.
As many people may not know this, but her father is one of the greatest Buddhist scholars in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So as a family trip, they used to go to Tibet. They used to like to go high atop the mountain, and in a section that we call Celestial Excursions, it's a very spiritual, quiet, calming place. So that's where she went. But other people go someplace else, obviously.
That must cost a pretty serious chunk of change to go to Tibet. And I imagine with her connections, she's probably hanging out in a jacuzzi with the Dalai Lama himself. Am I wrong?
Well, considering the Dalai Lama is really good friends with her father, I think that she has good access there. But, you know, it depends what you want.
Sure.
And I think that the key thing is that, you know, we're in a world that's burdened by subjectivity. Like right now, this Mark, okay, is saying, I want San Diego. And I'm, of course, going, huh? And you may, of course, want St. Bart's.
Mm-hmm.
So the point is
sure, I'll take St. Bart's.
Right.
I will too. I just I thought it was San Diego, but I'll take St. Bart's.
All right. Well, the thing is that you have options. Like we have one story in here. Like, who would know if people really like just to be really taken away? And smell is a really terrific sense. So we asked Jo Malone, the fragrance queen, tell us the 8 most aromatic hotels in the world and why.
That's hilarious. So let's talk about it, because I've been in some pretty stinky ones.
Exactly. Yeah. You don't know, right?
And you don't know what the smell is either.
Well,
some hotels. Yeah.
But some places are just really amazing. Like she mentioned something, like at the Park Hyatt in Tokyo, the smell of ginger tea permeates everywhere.
Wow.
And then there's a place in Mamounia, all right, which is in Marrakesh. And the tea on the table is fragrant with all these essences and orange blossoms, and it just really just takes you to another place.
Is there a hotel in Jamaica that smells like reefer?
Oh, I'm sure that you would find that in the grill. Someplace in the grill, but she didn't mention that. Or maybe in Amsterdam.
Yeah.
Where it's legal.
Yeah, absolutely. Everything smells like reefer. Well, that's a very interesting approach. I also like the approach of the list of the top six hotels to have an affair in.
Yes.
In New York. Now, I want to make it
clear. I'm refusing myself from this. Where, I'm a happily married man.
But that doesn't mean we can't have an affair with our wives.
And that's what I said. Oh. See, here, let's just talk first about what the essence of this magazine is. That you were not, first of all, I think people are so overwhelmed by information. You don't want to have to navigate through 4,000 words to just figure out, okay, where do I go and why? And usually you have a journalist that will parachute into a place and tell you, I had a great pina colada, here's the beach. Great, but are they really an expert? Our whole magazine is based on lists. So who is going to know more about the sexiest place, hotel rooms in the world and where people tend to go to than the number one infidelity expert?
Right.
And so therefore we went there. It was, hold on, I have to get to the page, of course. I remember her.
The number one infidelity expert.
Well, she's an author who wrote The Unforgivable, you know, The Forgivable Sin and why people have affairs and how you can actually repair your marriage.
So she's basically saying that if you're going to have an affair, she would know where to really do it up.
Well, she would know. Oh, look, here's an example. Bo Dietl, all right? The best restaurants for secret rendezvous.
We know Bo Dietl, right?
Oh, yeah.
He's on our show.
Right. Well. So you know what I mean. It's the same thing, but he's really a really good source. Like
Maybe for restaurants.
Restaurants. He's tracked people down. But the other thing is that we're still in fall right now. So I was
just starting,
and it's, you know, the leaves are starting to turn.
It's great.
So we also asked somebody who had traveled around the world, who was a landscape photographer, the five best places to see fall.
That sounds great. Where are they? Because I'm going to Vermont.
The Alaskan wilderness.
I've been there. I've flown over.
White Mountains, New Hampshire, Boone, North Carolina. In the San Juan Mountains in Colorado.
Oh, that'd be great.
And the Allegheny National Forest in Pennsylvania.
Really? No Vermont?
It wasn't Vermont. But that's what's so interesting, because this is an expert. So they're saying, I give you the perspective. Romantic surprises?
Well, how about those hotels where we can have an affair?
Oh, okay. I'll tell you what they are.
Because,
always goes there.
Well, because of my marriage situation now.
Yeah, need someplace like
that. Well, it'd be nice, because we see each other so infrequently, and she lives on another coast, so it'd be nice if she came in for the week, and if I could, spend a good chunk of my pay on trying to impress her.
But you want to know what? Yeah. This is what I wrote about in the editor's letter, and really what makes this magazine different, aside from that the list format, which is so easy to get to, is that, you know, I look at my vacation, is the opportunity, you know, to rekindle the burnt-out flames of romance and basically put hot newlywed sex in a married-with-kids life.
You know how else you can do that? By not living in the same city, I'm finding.
Possibly. Okay. But whatever your situation this is the first magazine that acknowledges that a lot of vacations are really to rekindle romance or find romance, the opportunity to meet and greet. And we are really addressing that and saying, this is what you can do for just this great new experience.
What do you got?
Now, for the affair hotels, okay? And by the way, the writer was, the expert that we went to was Dr. Bonnie Eaker Weil, and she was the author. She suggested, the Carlyle Hotel in Manhattan.
I know that place.
Oh, that was where Bobby Short was for so long.
That's correct, right.
Cafe Carlyle.
Right, so it's like 1940s.
Right.
Music. All right. Gurney's Inn in Montauk, off-season. because you had the waves lapping and
it's
nobody's
gray
really
out
there.
And no one's there.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's where the melancholy affair.
Yeah.
Right? Well, see, the whole point is, it's just like you put on a new pair of clothes every day, depending on what your mood is. You can create moods with hotels also. Why
that's
not?
That's for the affair where you're like, this is the last time. This is it.
All right. Yeah.
And whatever
well,
you do, don't drive out
to. This is a travel savvy list for you, right? It's all about being savvy and realizing that you can have different experiences based on what you feel at that moment. And you have choices and options. You can just, like, roam and figure out, okay, what do I feel like?
What's the next one?
Soho Grand.
Oh, that's a nice hotel.
All right. Now, there was another hotel that I must confess.
I actually did something bad in the Soho Grand.
Oh, well, tell us. Come on. It's only us and how many listeners out there?
Yeah.
That was the other life. Yeah. But it was good.
I used to hang out in Soho during the days before the Soho.
Yeah, it's a pretty new hotel. It's a pretty stunning hotel. I actually been there recently to have coffee meeting in the restaurant. They have a beautiful bar and a nice restaurant there.
Right. Mm-hmm. So there are all this. All right. Then there's a whole Hotel Gansevoort, which I hadn't really heard of, and then
that's
now everybody's
too.
Told me.
That's
right by the far west side, near where Florence.
It's right
where
by we Florence. Yeah. It's a beautiful place. I think it was the guys who built that do some other hotels here in the city. I'm not sure which ones, but it's
not Ian Schrager. No,
I don't think it is Ian Schrager, but it's a pretty mod kind of cool hotel.
Right. And then you have the sensuous hotels, like if you want to go outside, you know, the New York area, and you know, Parrot Cay and Turks and Caicos. The Angkor Resort in Bhutan is absolutely beautiful. If you're really looking for the exotic, there's nothing that really compares to that.
Well, I have to look at the magazine. Do you have a website affiliated with the magazine yet?
We do. It's called TravelSavvyMag.com. But we are really working as being on the site right now. I mean, it just will, you know, give you the basic information, and within the next month we'll have all our list on there. But we have so many cool things coming up. Like, let's hear a list from you. What list would you guys
want to
hear?
Well, I got one for you right off the bat. As a retired club goer, I see Damon Dash actually had a list of the five hippest clubs. And you let him put his own place on there?
Well, here's the thing. The reason is that... these guys are an expert on partying, all right? And when he puts his name, because he's all about branding, on his club, by most people's definition, is very cool. And that's the whole point of this, that what makes it so authentic is that the expert is an expert in that world. So, of course, he's going to put it on because that's one of his choices.
Sure.
Okay.
But the rest of them, I mean, where else are you going to get such a great list?
Did he put Jay-Z's on there? I don't think so right now. I don't know if they're feuding or not.
You know, it's like one of those things that, like, you know, it depends what day of the week. Are you, hey, buddy? Or
sure.
You know.
Yeah. Is there a list where of places where I can go and never have to work again and will be taken care of on a day-to-day
basis?
Well,
we will just give you a list of the five best lotteries, around the country, each state lottery, and which one you have the most likely opportunity to win.
Yeah.
But then we wouldn't be able to chat this morning, and we would miss you, and, like, you know, you shouldn't be rich and famous. You know?
You can call in.
Well, we'll call you from the beach. At what beach?
Yeah, what beach? I was just in Kauai, and I love that island. I thought that was great. Vacations are very important to me right now because this is the first time that I've actually had a job that I go to every day, and I never really realized that without vacations, there'd be no reason to go through life. You know, that, like, if you have a job and you have no vacation time coming up, why not just put a bullet in your head? It's just
my magazine, but the other thing is that it also inspires you about possibility.
Yeah.
And I think that that's really true. People have to really plan vacations and realize that they really, really are restorative and inspirational.
Spas. Do you have a top list of spas?
We have lots of the top spas, but, you know, based on different things. See, here's the thing. I want to just point out something that you had said earlier, Mark, which I think, are we breaking for commercial or something?
Well,
no, let's just go to commercial, whatever you want to do.
Look at her. What are we going to say to Mark real quick?
All right. What I was going to say is that just the options are so many, but they've become so overwhelming. And what Travel Savvy does is help you make the great decisions for the fun, sensual, inspiring vacations. And the experts really know what they're talking about.
Okay. Well, that's good enough to go out on, I think. Yeah, Jill Brook, thank you for being with us.
Thanks, guys.
It was great having you. Maybe we'll talk to you again. We'll be back. What are we going to talk about? We got the Liberal Confessional coming up, and we've also got
Product Placement Minute.
46 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition, delivering you from evil in 3 hours or less. Air America Radio.
51 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hey.
We were just asking Jill Brooke on the break there about Australia and New Zealand. That's what Dan Pashman just asked him. She's going to have Peter Jackson, the guy who directed Lord of the Rings.
Oh, okay.
Write the thing on New Zealand, and maybe Cameron Crowe going to write it in Australia.
Russell Crowe.
Cameron Crowe we're going to talk to tomorrow, right?
Yeah.
Okay, he's the guy that directed me in Almost Famous, which is a movie that a lot of people don't realize is about my character, the angry promoter. Cameron Crowe did a revolutionary thing by actually building a movie around not just a secondary character, but really almost a glorified cameo role. And it really depends how you look at it, because when I watch Almost Famous, I look at it as a movie that is a film about me. Okay, and a lot of people see it as about a band and about a kid's rites of passage, but I really think it's a perception thing. And
well,
I
mean, it wasn't called Almost Famous for nothing, Marin.
I'm going to let that slide off of my back.
Wait a minute, what's wrong?
There's nothing wrong.
You're letting it slide off your back, there's something wrong.
Nah, that's all right, Pashman's got problems. We don't need to go into him. He likes to call it passion. I like to call it obsessive compulsive disorder. But that hasn't happened before. Yeah. Hey, Dan, you know what, man? You're doing a good job.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, thanks a lot. All right, we just got another call from management at Air America Radio saying this show has to make more money, Riley, in order to buy a paper to print notices saying there won't be any Christmas bonuses again. So here's today's product placement. So Riley, what's our product placement story today?
The FBI captured one of its most wanted criminals last week, and he's been accused of kidnapping, false imprisonment with violence, child molestation, child pornography, sexual assault on a spouse. I mean, it goes on and on with this guy.
And I'll be selling products from QVC Home Shopping Network. We have some beautiful items today, Riley.
Gary Edward Lasher has been on the run for a year and a half before turning up in a Caribbean resort city working as a surfing instructor. Among other things, this guy beat his mother-in-law unconscious and stuffed her into the trunk of his car.
And our first item is an adorable Prayer Bear musical water globe. Inside the globe is a teddy bear putting a smaller bear to bed. And on top is a napping teddy bear angel. Call in the next half hour and it's yours for $27.32 plus shipping.
Lasher is also accused of occasionally beating his wife into unconsciousness as well as raping and sodomizing her all on videotape.
Speaking of wives, here's a little something for the missus. A dazzling 7-inch sterling gemstone bangle bracelet with the gem prong set to graduate in size. Look at it sparkle, Riley.
Ooh, nice. Lasher's only defense so far is, quote, I was under the influence of drugs. I did a lot of things I don't remember too clearly.
Which brings us to this adorable Hummel figurine called Little Pharmacist. Made of fine earthenware, it's an inquisitive little boy dressed up to play pharmacist, complete with a lab coat and a pair of glasses on his forehead. $276.50.
But police in Arizona also say they found 9,000 images of child pornography on Lasher's computer. Hey, Mark, what's that?
It's clothes for your dog. From the folks at Jazzy Couture, it's an all-weather trench coat with a water-repellent exterior with a McQueen plaid lining. And see, look at that. There's a matching hat.
Lasher is accused of sexually assaulting a 9-year-old girl. Boy, a dog would look hilarious in that thing.
Uh-huh. And that's today's Morning Sedition product placement. Is there any of your music there?
No.
I feel like there should be music there. No?
Why don't we get them to sing in the background? We got enough people.
Oh, boy. Listen to this. Brother Kenneth M. Hoagland, the principal of Kellenberg Memorial High School in Uniondale, Long Island, is canceling the school's prom because it has gotten too decadent.
Woo.
He is morally disgusted at the vanity and excess that misrepresents the students and the idea of prom altogether. He cites students putting down $10,000 to rent a party house in the Hamptons, pre-prom cocktail parties followed by a trip to the dance in a liquor-loaded limo, fathers chartering a boat for their children's late-night booze cruise. To quote Hoagland, it is not primarily the sex, booze, and drugs that surround this event, as problematic as they might be. It is rather the flaunting of affluence, assuming exaggerated expenses, a pursuit of vanity for vanity's sake, in a word, financial decadence.
Some parents, of course, went ahead and rented the Hamptons house anyways, and will go ahead with the prom on some level. But I think there's a point to be made about this, Riley. Things have changed since I was going to prom. I mean, I knew there were some expenses, but it was really just a crappy tux and a corsage. And outside of that, we drove our own cars, we got our own drugs, and bought our own liquor.
Well, yeah, I mean, when I was coming up, the highlight of anybody's prom was the group that played. I mean, there were some high schools that would go out and spend a whole bunch of money to get, like, the Temptations or the Four Tops, believe it or not, to perform. That's what they spend all the money on. Everybody, the rest of the way, I mean, you look sharp and all of that. But, you know, $10,000 for a, you know, for a house to have a party in, you know, I mean, the liquor, the drugs, the sex, that's always been part of prom night.
And also puts a, yeah, and also puts a pressure on kids who can't afford it, and they shouldn't have to. I mean, what's memorable about prom really is, you know, just this sort of, you know, sad attempt to have sex with a girl that probably doesn't really like you enough to do it. And then, you know, the crying, and then, you know, the throwing up on the tuxedo. I guess this is, I'm personalizing this too much, but maybe that's not everyone's
experience. What happened? The window didn't open or what?
Man, of course the window didn't open. I don't even think
The window was open. You were doing 50 and it just all flew back.
Well, yeah, that's happened too. You know, high school was not a party for me, Riley, even with the imposed prom.
Me neither. I went to military school for 3 years, for God's sake.
Oh, my God. What did you got? Did you have a prom? Did you have to bring people in? How'd that work?
No, you had to bring people in.
Oh, all right. Well, yeah. Well, I'm sorry, Cam McCullough, for for treating you that way. And I wish it would have went better that night. 57 past. We'll be back with the Liberal Confessional. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Six past the hour. Good morning. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Yep.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking, crying conservatives. I know that you're sad because you're in trouble. And, of course, all you entitled, well-to-do liberals who think that civil rights is how you treat your nanny. You know, we were just talking about this guy who canceled, the principal who canceled the prom because it was too decadent. And now I'm having prom flashbacks, Pashman. I'm remembering there was hotel rooms rented, but they were not fancy hotel rooms. We did go out to a nice dinner, but what does a nice dinner really cost in Albuquerque, New Mexico? When it comes to, you know what I mean? When it comes to putting yourself in hock, you know, and these, you know, $10,000, ballrooms rented and this kind of stuff. We didn't do that.
Well, Maron, John Crimmings was just telling me on the break that his town up in Wisconsin has some sort of elaborate multi-town celebration where people show up in elephants and there's food from all over the place, and it sounds pretty decadent itself. What about that, John?
Yeah, they just made a documentary about it.
Really?
Yeah.
So is that? But that comes out of what, state money or city money, or how is it a big celebration?
I think like a local community organization donates a lot of the money, and you know, you pay a little bit extra in tickets, but
I got to be honest with you. I think most parents, outside of whatever they're doing, jockeying for status by using their kids, they do that with bar mitzvahs, communions, all kinds of stuff. But I think most parents just want their kids to be someplace safe. That was always the idea in terms of my parents, were like, you know, okay, if you're going to rent a hotel room so you can have a party, just go there and stay there. What's the phone number? Or they want to know where you are. Yeah. Is usually what the deal is. And that's why the limo thing started happening. That was not because they wanted to travel in class. It was because the parents knew they were going to drink. They knew they were going to get out of control. So why not get five or six of them together and rent a car so they don't have to worry about the kids driving into a tree?
Yeah, you can always hose down a limo after.
that's got nothing to do with you. That's on the guy who owns the limo. Yeah.
Riley knows a guy who cleans out a limo. He'll never know anything happened.
Yeah.
Here's some good news. If we can switch gears a little bit, get a little news out there before we get to the Liberal Confessional. Look, apparently federal
Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald's grand jury might be laying out indictments as early as tomorrow, but better yet, we've heard word that, from the Daily News that somebody flipped. He's got a snitch on the inside, and it might be possible that Cheney will be implicated in this thing in terms of if he goes after a conspiracy indictment. All Fitzgerald would have to do is show the vice president was an active participant in a decision to smear Joe Wilson. I know he was. How hard could it be to prove?
This is very interesting because it will be the first time the vice presidency has been touched with this kind of criminal taint since the early 1970s and a guy by the name of Spiro T. Agnew, who ended up pleading nolo contendere to some corruption charges back in the day and having to resign as vice president.
And here's another little tidbit of GOP demise. Tom DeLay will likely be booked in a Texas county jail this week, despite the attempts on behalf of his attorneys to bypass the printing and mugshot part of the booking. Apparently, DeLay is going to have to go through the whole perp walk, print, mugshot part of the booking. His arraignment is set for Friday before District Judge Bob Perkins in Travis County, Texas, who, as Riley pointed out, what did he say, Riley?
He said if God was charged with a felony, he'd have to go through the booking process.
Another interesting tidbit about the DeLay situation is that apparently he was offered a deal.
Yep.
And of course his pride would not enable him to take that deal. He was offered a deal to plead guilty of a misdemeanor violation of election law, as opposed to being indicted on felony criminal conspiracy and money laundering charges. Now I'm assuming that he just said, I'm not guilty of nothing. To hell with you. I'm not, there's no deal. Who are you? I'm Tom DeLay.
Yeah.
And now look at him. Two indictments against him for felonies.
Well, one of the things that we're starting to see take place here is that this arrogance of power is starting to come apart. And it's going to come apart with Tom DeLay. Probably sometime during the perp walk, he's going to realize, wait a minute, they're treating me like a criminal here.
Yeah, here's another interesting thing that's also coming out of the White House. It's just amazing how smoothly things don't run when Karl Rove isn't around. They're trying to remake. They're giving Harriet Myers a makeover. Mm. They're trying to completely take away the evangelical pitch. And now they're going to try to resurrect her with the help of Newt Gingrich, oddly, with the help of God knows how many Republican stooges giving testimonials and op-eds, and with the help of a Bush family stooge and RNC operative up in New Hampshire to coerce senators into voting for Myers, or else they're going to get screwed out of some money in the future. But the bottom line is like, how can they reinvent this woman? We already know everything we're going to know. Are they going to all of a sudden pull something out of the bag and go, oh, wait, we just found out she was a judge?
Hey, wait a minute. If Truth or Dare Madonna can make herself into some prophet of the end times for sinning,
yeah,
then maybe they can remake Harriet Myers. Why not?
No, because they are the end times.
You're right about that.
So I think that as we talk about before, that the nomination's probably dead. I am frightened as to what'll happen in the shadow of that and who they're going to put up there, but I don't think that this woman is going to fly, because their big worry is Sam Brownback, the theocrat from Texas, is going to vote no from Kansas sorry is going to vote no in the nomination. He's a Republican on the Judiciary
Committee.
That
could very well doom it before it even gets out of committee. And Brownback doesn't scare the way some of these other people do. If Brownback wants to run for president in 08, he will do so even if he does scuttle Harriet Myers' nomination.
That's right. It's not always being a liberal. We all stray from the straight and narrow occasionally, from time to time. But when we need to unburden ourselves, we can always confess our liberal sins. If you want to take a turn in the liberal confessional, give us a call at 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270. But right now it's my turn. Bless me, Brother Riley, for I have sinned.
How can I ease your burden, my son?
Well, a couple of weeks ago we were at Maxwell's over there in New Jersey, and we did that bit called Bruce Cherry's Pitch of the Week, where he played a pollster named Sal Alacious. Chris, can we hear some of that, buddy? Yeah? No, it's not going to happen? All right. Well, look, he's a guy,
He did say polled a lot. I do remember that part.
Yeah, that is true. And a couple of listeners didn't think it was all that funny and wrote in saying those kind of jokes provoke violence towards women.
That's kind of interesting. And did you write them back in a polite, reasonable manner? Since we're getting to the guilty part, Mark, what did you say?
All right, I said, first, we are not promoting violence against women in any way.
Okay, that sounds reasonable, but what's next?
And all right. Okay, and then I said, I certainly would never accuse you of not being able to take a joke. I'm actually surprised you were able to identify one.
There it is. Couldn't let it go, could you? There's more, too, isn't there?
Well, I tried to close on a positive note. I also said, thanks again for listening and being a righteous person. It is so necessary in the world we live in today. It really helps.
Yo, don't try to play me, man. I can hear the sarcasm. I know you. You forgot that?
All right, but she was so hostile and smug and humorless.
Part of being liberal is being able to hear opinions you don't agree with without responding in a hostile way.
Okay, all right, you're right. I shouldn't let people push my buttons. I mean, There are a lot of people that do think the show is funny.
Exactly. However, as penance, I think you should do a couple of gigs at a women's shelter just to remind you that we have all kinds of people listening to this show.
All right. I guess I can do that. All right. One more thing, Riley.
Yeah?
She also said this, quote, "You two are a couple of jerks who are not funny, not smart, and should certainly not be taking up the prime time air of a morning show," unquote.
What? Jerks? What the?
All right. See, not easy, is it?
Okay. Thank you for listening. We appreciate your opinion. Now, Mark, go forth and sin no more.
Amen. Thank you, Brother Riley. Now, if anyone else out there wants to confess and seek absolution in our liberal confessional, you can give us a call right now at 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270. We'll be back with you in the booth. In just a second, it's 15 past the hour, Morning Sedition on Air America.
Join the Morning Sedition right now. Call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
Hey, it's 19 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. We're taking confessions at 866-303-2270. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hi.
Man, the phone lines are packed.
Sure are.
Jeff in San Francisco, what is your confession, Jeff?
Hey, Jeff.
Oh, good morning. I went deer hunting.
Wow.
And I liked it.
Oh. Did you kill one?
I did. But I explained to him that my people have been doing this to your people for countless years.
You explained that to the deer?
I did.
You called the deer a person?
No.
Oh.
I call the deer jerky.
Oh, so you went out, you shot a deer, you gutted it, you cut it up, and now it's in your freezer?
Some of it's in my freezer, some of it's sitting on the counter in the bag. Made it jerky.
And I'm not hearing a lot of guilt. I know
that I don't hear any guilt.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I liked it.
And you'd never gone hunting before?
I've attempted walking around in the woods with a gun.
Yeah. Well,
but,
okay, well
that's not hunting, that's stalking.
That's stalking, yes. It was hiking with a gun.
Well, here, I got something for you. Wait, is hunting season still going?
No, my zone just closed.
Oh. Well, next hunting season, I think instead of taking a hike with a gun, I want you to take a hike with antlers on.
You still got the antlers from the deer you killed?
I do.
That you mercilessly slaughtered?
I do. Okay.
Just for fun and just to experience fear at the sound of gunshots. And the panic of running and trying to, you know, fight for your life. You've always got the option to go, wait, I'm just a guy with antlers on. But I think that's your penance.
Hopefully you won't be too late.
Just to experience what the deer might have gone through but probably doesn't remember.
Thank you, sir. May I have another?
All right, Jeff, thanks for calling.
Thanks, Jeff.
He's
going to eat every bit of that jerky, every bit of the venison, the whole nine yards.
He didn't feel guilty.
He didn't feel guilty at all.
Well, you know, there's a rationalization that goes along with deer hunting, which may not be a rationalization or not. I'm not going to come down on trying to know the truth about this, but I grew up in a place where they enable deer hunting. And one of it is that it's population control. They kind of have this, the National Gaming Commission, I guess, or the State Gaming Commission says that if the deers aren't killed, that they will starve to death. you know, at certain points in the year. So I don't know if that's true, but I know people that hunt, and some people grew up with it, and on some level, if they're
some people hunt because it makes them feel good.
Yeah, yeah. That's probably the only reason outside of the reason of wanting to kill your own food. And God knows, given the state of the meat industry, if you're going to eat it, you're better off bringing up your own or going out and getting your own than you are eating it off the rack. That's for sure. All right, so here we go. Travis in Miami. Travis, what's your confession?
Hey, Travis.
Hello, Brother Maron. Hello, Brother Riley.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very, very guilty.
Uh-huh.
I thought that Judith Miller was protecting the freedom of the press, and I want to confess my sin.
As opposed to just protecting the freedom of Judith Miller?
Yeah, well, she didn't do a great job of that, did she?
So, well, okay, so you were misled, my friend, and as were many people were misled into that argument about Judith Miller protecting the freedom of speech as opposed to protecting the vice president or, you know, Republican operative.
Earl Scooter.
Yeah, so, you know, I think as a... What do we have to do to... I think, you know, you're going to have to go out and perhaps solicit subscriptions to The Nation.
There you go.
You're going to have to give up your... Yes, you're going to have to give up your subscription to The New York Times. And and you're going to have to go out and work for The Nation soliciting subscriptions.
Well, The Nation better be ready for me.
Thank you, Travis. I'm glad we could help.
Thank you, brother, man. Thank you, brother. Man.
Yes, thank you. Yes, thank sir. You, Travis.
Wow. Okay.
Well, he was easy.
Yeah, he was. All right. I hope we're helping. Catherine in Atlanta, what's your confession, Catherine?
Hey, Catherine.
Hi, how are you?
Yes, I'm fine. How are you? How can we help you today?
Well, I'm feeling really guilty because I'm a chair of one of the Sierra Club groups in Georgia.
Yeah.
And they're having a chapter retreat this weekend, and I really don't want to go.
Why?
Because environmentalists are not really...
they're not cool, are they?
No,
you're not hip. You're not down with them.
I don't want to eat.
You'd rather go to a hip hop club, wouldn't you?
Wait.
Yes. See, I knew it.
You don't want? Did you just say you don't want to eat granola?
I don't want to eat granola. They're having a chili cook off. I don't want to do that.
So let me understand this. Are you saying that you find environmentalists / kind of liberal sorts kind of boring and too earnest?
Oh.
And this is a leader in the Sierra Club, folks. A leader we're talking to here.
These are my people, but, I mean, you know, it's not really what I would do on a Saturday night.
Well, here's what you're going to have to do. As a penance, you're going to have to turn that party around.
Yeah. I would say you've got an iPod on you or something? Fill it up with hip-hop songs, take it to the retreat, and have your own party at the retreat. Show them how it's done.
And organic moonshine.
Yeah,
yeah, there you
and
go.
Put meat in the chili.
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay. I'll right. Pay the money and go.
All right,
thank
Catherine.
You.
Thank
hey.
You. Glad we could help out.
We get a commission from the Sierra Club for making sure their leadership shows up on retreat.
It actually makes the party fun.
Yeah, right.
Oh, I know that feeling. The feeling of, you know...
I don't want to be here.
Yeah, you know, just... Okay, let's take Chris in Iowa. Chris, what's your sin, Chris?
Hey, Chris.
Hey there.
How you doing? I'm fine. How you doing? What's eating at your soul, Chris?
Well, I have a liberal love of knowledge.
Yes.
I read a lot of books. Mm. My friends are liberals, and we all read a lot of books. Mm-hmm. And I borrow books from my friends, and, well, I trash their books. I mistreat books. I, like, you know, spill my burrito on the book. I dog you the pages. The cover's all bent. If I borrow paperback, I can't. I'm shamed. I mean, I hand them back, and they just look at me. I mean, I'm by my friends. I'm a book abuser, I guess.
You're a book abuser.
Spine buster?
I think it's called, what is it? I don't know what the clinical name is, but it probably has something to do with the Libris molestation.
Libris.
Yeah, biblio molestation. Yeah, something like that. Well, I think that there is a penance here because it seems to me not only do you mistreat books, but you mistreat your friends, and you apparently don't buy books. So, well, what you're going to have to do, I'm afraid, is you're going to have to, you know, buy some books, or it's your choice, either buy some books and give them to a library, or go on a book drive and provide books to a school.
That would be good.
Oh, okay.
That seems reasonable, right? Doesn't it, Chris?
That works.
Okay, all thanks right, for Chris. Thanks for calling. Glad we could help out. You take care. It's now 27 past the hour. You're listening to Morning Sedition. We have Frederick Kaufman coming out here. He's a writer for Harper's Magazine, also the author of a book called A Short History of the American Stomach. He's going to come and we're going to explore the similarities between watching the Food Channel and watching porn.
Yeah,
that should
baby.
Be good. Hang out for that. 27 past.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
All right, it's 34 past the hour. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hi.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Wow, it's been a pretty good morning. I just found out something secret about our next guest that I'm going to get into in just a minute.
Uh-oh.
We might have to bring a special guest from our own crew in here to suss this out.
Is Talk about a confessional.
Is it suss out or suss out? Am I saying
suss
that
out.
Right? Suss out? All
yeah.
right. 90 million households tune into the Food Network each year, but are people really watching to learn how to cook? I know I'm not. Our next guest is here to tell us why the Food Network has been such a growing phenomenon. He's just written an article in this month's Harper's Magazine called Debbie Does Salad, The Food Network at the Frontiers of Pornography. He also has a book coming out called A Short History of the American Stomach. Please welcome to Morning Sedition, Frederick Kaufman. Good morning, Fred.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning, Fred.
I'm glad you're here, dude, because I got to be honest with you, man. I was early on board with the Food Network, early on. You know, I used to do a joke about it in my act. I was completely obsessed with it. I like to learn how to cook, but I think that I do not watch it generally for the cook, for learning how to cook. I watch it because I find it satisfying. And I think that, you know, that must have something to do with the similarities between Food Network and porn. Huh?
Well, it's virtually satisfying. So on a very deep level, it's not satisfying.
Uh-oh.
So you're saying that, well, the joke I used to do was like, how are you going to, you know, is that that there's no shortage of storyline or narrative? Because, you know, when the guy's like, you know, we're going to see what happens to those onions later. You know, this whole idea that, like, we're going to add this and then it's going to become this whole thing. Virtually, you're saying, but mentally it is satisfying, no?
Well, of course, you know, that's one of the great satisfactions of sexual porn, too, is the same as the satisfaction of gastro porn, which is that you only get the happy ending.
No, but the thing is that it's a little different in that when you watch the Food Network, you don't get to eat it. All right? At least if you're watching regular porn and you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, you get closure.
Well, you know, what
is that what you call it?
It was something.
What are you supposed to be doing? I mean, I think the model of
Come
porn
on, you know what you're supposed to
that
be doing.
We're working with is this kind of really sad model of alienation. You know, you're watching these outrageous acts of intimacy up on this little video. It's not you, but somehow that makes up for it. I'm not quite sure. And same with food. You don't get to eat it. That's absolutely right.
Okay, I understand that. Outrageous acts of intimacy. That's an interesting way to put it.
Yeah.
And I'm sure some people will be like, I don't see any intimacy there. But I think generally speaking... And
well, clearly
I'm,
a physical intimacy, if not a...
Yeah, it's sex.
Emotional.
It's sex,
yeah, I just thought it was sexual gymnastics.
Yeah, but
well, this is food gymnastics.
Okay, and I understand what you're trying... I understand the point you're making, that as media material, as something that we're seeing on television or specifically on television, that they both are similar, but I'm assuming that, you know, most people who watch porn aren't just watching, and most people who watch the Food Channel, if they are watching somebody make a filet mignon, there's a real good chance that they might be sitting there eating Cheetos while they're doing it, which is disappointing, as is the other thing.
Yeah, precisely. It's exactly parallel, but what you're getting is, in your own head, you're getting the same kind of what I call a splanknik response, is kind of intense, involuntary, nervous response to seeing this phenomena in front of you. And I think that's what's interesting about comparing food porn to gastro porn, is that you get, is that they're both working on you mentally in the same way. And in fact, they're not working on your, what I call your upper brain, your higher brain, your brain of ratiocination, the one that allows you to think. They're working on your lower brain, your involuntary brain, the one that simply allows you to react. And that's why I think on a certain level, it's kind of dangerous when you have this co-option by other media of what porn has perfected. I have no problem with porn, but when I see other media like the Food Network or particularly something like Network News taking over where porn has paved the way, then I think you have some sort of a dangerous situation.
Well, what specific elements of pornographic stylings are you talking about in terms of, I understand it with food. Are these cinematographic elements? Are they narrative elements? Because the thing I notice is the similarities on the Food Network. You know you're going to see the cake at the end. You know, and similarly in porn, you know, you're going to see the icing. So now what I want to know is what elements of pornography are you seeing in the news?
That's the great question. That's it. I think ultimately what you're getting in the news increasingly is this reliance on the sphincter response, the response, the immediately emotional response. It's like, you know, Van Gordon Sauter really paved the way in the 1980s when he's preaching to the troops at CNN. It's about the emo. It's about the emo. And then, of course, when Jonathan Klein takes over CNN US this past very early this year, he did the same thing. He has his great story, Rallying the Troops. It's about the story. It's about the story. Well, where does the emo and the story come from? The emo comes from the gut. Right, the gut makes the wow, and the wow makes the money.
So you're saying it's provoking the same response,
absolutely, that same form.
Right, there is like a lot of Republicans like this stuff, like the Fox News. It is completely biased,
visceral.
You're right, it's visceral, and it gives you the anger buzz, and it gives you that closure of being narrow-minded and right. It gives you the payoff, is what you're talking about.
What you get, yeah, you get this. The anger response is the perfect one because that's an involuntary one. Your blood pressure rises, your body temperature rises. These are all the involuntary nervous reactions that porn paved the way in figuring out how are we going to get people to feel something when they're not there. And this is what the Food Network has co-opted, and this is what news is increasingly using.
Now, are people in the food business and in the news business conscious of this co-optation? But now they have a background in porn. How did they make the connection?
Well, a lot of people in media do have a background in porn.
It's true.
Are you talking about us?
Well, no, a lot of filmmakers do, and also the people that make music videos as well.
Sure. If you go on the set of any porn film, you'll see, you know, guys, men and women right out of film school, they're holding the sea light. You know, they get the really nasty jobs. But,
yeah, the question was revolving around are people.
Is it inadvertent or is it deliberate?
It's deliberate. If you talk to the people who were on the sets of the old Julia Child show, they were talking about food porn back then. They would make jokes about it. They have the shot of the steak with the juice running out of the grilled cheese with the cheese trickling down. And they say it's food porn. Baby. They laugh and they all know it and they're all aware of it and they're aware of it today and they're very conscious.
But
absolutely.
Is there a problem?
Is there a problem
with? Yeah,
I don't think there's a problem with gastro porn. Right, no, I don't see this as like the end of Western civilization. Although it is kind of interesting to me that you see increasingly a male demographic watching this, and they're single men sitting at the bars watching the Yankees on one screen, watching Rachel Ray on the other, and there's your virtual wife making you virtual dinner. And
there's a couple things going on there. I got to be honest with you. That's not all about the food because we talk about her a bit here. We tried to get her on the show, and not that she didn't want to, but we all seem to have some sort of weird fascination with Rachel.
Well, did you see her spread in FHM?
No.
No.
Oh, yeah, you missed this.
Kalo did. Now, this is interesting. I didn't realize that you had this connection to one of our crew here. Frederick Kaufman, who his new book is called The History of the American Stomach, A Short History of the American Stomach. He also has a piece about food porn in the New Harper's, was also a teacher of Kalo the Costco Ho, of our very own Chris Lopresto.
He was one of my students.
Uh-oh.
Oh, yes. Man, what could that have even been like?
He was fabulous. He was fabulous. He always knew all the correct answers, and he was an amazing student.
Hold on. This is Chris Lopresto.
Not Chris Lopresto.
Oh, okay.
Somebody else. I was about to say.
Fred's classes were so easy, I gotta say. But the best part about Fred's classes is that all the hot women wanted to be in there. You know why?
Why?
Because they all found him really cute.
Wow!
So I would go in there, and because...
What did he teach?
Journalism.
Okay,
journalism, of course.
Magazine writing and stuff. It was simple course.
I would teach them how to, you know, take pornography and co-opt it for their own use.
There was a lot of porn talk in there. There was a lot of sexual talk. It was great. I got laid a lot because of your class.
I'm glad to know that.
Are you still teaching?
Of course. That's, as soon as we're done here, I'm heading out to Staten Island. Absolutely.
Well, I hope you keep that job. Thanks for helping the guy out. Caleb just basically said, "Look, this class was easy. There were girls
and girls."
Hey, I got tenure now.
All right, so that's interesting, and I see you've done a lot with that, with the journalism thing.
Yeah, don't you think? Yeah, I'm like Air America Radio. Yeah, I'm doing good.
There you go.
Chris is a great success story of CSI.
Yes, I think I'm one of the only success stories of CSI.
That's not true.
What does that stand for?
College of Staten Island.
There you go.
Staten Island.
Yeah, man.
Is that Ivy League?
City University.
City University.
CUNY.
All right, all right. So, well, you can get in on this because certainly Kalo understands porn. The
understands it.
I live it. So you don't think that there is any intrinsic problem in food porn, but there is a problem with utilizing the techniques and the teasing element of pornography in, I imagine, it's been used in commercials, but certainly in news and partisan and biased news and propaganda.
Look, it's about perfecting the spin. I mean, how do you think the Republicans won the last election? It was with sphincters. People were not voting with their brains.
They voted with their sphincters?
Absolutely.
Now, let me see if I understand exactly. I know a lot of sphincters voted for Bush.
he won the sphincter vote.
Yeah. You know, there are two separate and distinct anal sphincters.
Uh-huh.
You've got to know this.
Well, lay it on me. What do you got?
Well, the body is full of sphincters. People don't realize this. There are, you know, there are seven up and down the digestive tract. There are sphincters in your eyeballs. There are obviously sphincters in your sexual organs. But that's
so if a chick pokes me in the eye, you're telling me I could, like, get off?
Where did that? How did? What was it? What was the series of thoughts that led to that? That so you just said you just thought
that was the college of Staten Island thing.
No, Chris is absolutely right. He's absolutely right. What he's talking about clearly is fetish porn. The
no wonder why you like this teacher. Chris is absolutely right. How often do you hear that?
Professor is easy.
I'm going to bring this full circle for you. It's the Dominator sub fetish porn, which is most obviously clear in a food show like Iron Chef, absolutely, where you have the Dominator chefs with their brocade outfits and their black gloves. And
yes,
welcome to the dungeon.
Yeah, yeah.
And down comes the squid.
Oh, so that's the S&M version of porn?
Absolutely.
Of food porn?
That's absolutely right. And so Chris, is on the money.
Yeah.
Wow.
But
he's a great teacher.
You know, that was a...
You know, I've only watched one food show from beginning to end in my entire life.
Well, Riley, the problem with you is that you're like...
Which one was it? Iron Chef?
No. It was on Public Access. It was something called Biker Billy Cooks with Fire. That was,
you know, this is an area. This is a real frontier, the whole biker chef thing.
Yeah.
And you know,
this guy had been around for years. He dressed up in a black leather biker outfit, and he would just, like... You know, fry stuff.
He dominates that food.
Yeah.
But he was like, Riley likes four kinds of food. He likes four things, and that's it. So
the four basic food groups.
If it was a Riley food porn show, it would just have to be mac and cheese, white meat chicken dry.
Right.
But that's exactly the point, which is that Rachel Ray, you know, we love Ray Ray. We love Ray
great.
Ray, but she goes to the refrigerator, right? This is an amazing moment in American media. When we actually see this, where it's come to 90 million households, she goes to the refrigerator. She says, I'm going to make a salad. She pulls out the plastic container of pre-made salad.
Yeah.
She takes her bowl.
Yeah.
She pours it in.
Uh-huh.
There's the salad.
Oh, yeah.
This is amazingly, I mean, the absurdity to actually look at this and say, she's making a salad on television like this.
Dude, I have ramekins because of the Food Channel. Do you understand? I have little things. When I do prep, when I do food prep, I've got little dishes where I put the different, like, I'll line it all up before I do the cooking so I can actually cook like I'm on the food show occasionally.
You practice the chopping?
I do a lot of chopping, man. I do chopping. I do, I do a lot of work, dude. But see, now what you're making me feel like is now I completely realize, see, I am under the belief, Fred, that there are only two, things that are really important in terms of enjoying life. That is one, sticking things in your mouth and sticking other things other places. That is really what it comes down to, that food and sex are about the only real joys we have as life goes on, and that you just made me realize that when I'm cooking, I'm not really cooking. I'm doing some sort of strange pre-masturbatory thing, or actually a masturbatory thing before I actually feed myself, before I watch regular porn.
You're absolutely right.
Oh, that's
why we don't.
God.
That's why we don't want conservatives sticking things down our mouths, using co-opting those techniques. In other words, making it look attractive, making it look great, making it look like you want to swallow it, mm-hmm. and seducing you into swallowing it when it's just swill.
Yeah.
It's fake.
All right, so you're saying that when the pornography, when the techniques of pornography are utilized to distribute propaganda that isn't fun, it's bad.
Bad. B-A-D.
Yeah, okay. Well, look, Fred Kaufman, ex-teacher of Kalo, and also the author of Debbie Does Salad, the Food Network at the Frontiers of Pornography. That's in this month's Harper's. Also the book coming out called The Short History of the American Stomach. You know, it was actually very informative and probably deeper than we were allowed to get into talking to you.
It's deep.
Yeah, well, you threw a few word combinations together that had a lot of poetic, philosophical, and medical expertise. It had a real good punch to them.
Thank you, Mark.
To the point where I was like, wait, can we just deconstruct that sentence? We can get to that. And we will get to that again.
We'll do hermeneutics next time.
Hermeneutics would be great. The hermeneutic code is very important, and I vaguely understand it, but I'm sure right now a blogger is going, oh, the hermeneutic code is. It's 48 past the hour. We'll talk to whoever's here in just a second.
Thanks a lot.
Morning Sedition.
Just to wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
Let's put this thing down. You know, we only got a couple minutes here. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. We've got Kayla the Costco Ho in here, Holler. Whose teacher was just in here.
Holler.
Yeah, there I had go. No idea that he told me that in college Chris was the editor of the newspaper.
Editor-in-chief of the newspaper.
Why do you present yourself like such a lug?
What are you talking about?
I don't know. Who the hell would have known that?
I don't dress up in a suit and tie. And
no, I'm just saying I didn't know that. I feel like, you know, I'm impressed. That makes me happy to know that you have these other skills.
Yeah, for a year and a half I did that.
That's terrific. Yeah. And we got little Goliath in here. Did you do anything like that?
Take any weird classes like that? Or
what's
do
weird
it like
about
that?
Journalism?
Don't get them all flustered. Because then it's become...
Now, what college did you go to, Dave?
I went to Kenyon College in Ohio.
Yeah,
okay. Is that which was a weird place. It was out in the cornfields.
Was it a hippie school?
It was divided by hippies and preppies, and the preppy kids lived on the south end of the campus, and the hippies lived on the north end.
It wasn't like Hampshire or Reed, just one of those
not quite
Montessori type schools where they just sort of like, go ahead and make up your class. you can teach your own
I looked
class
at Hampshire.
Major in art? Go ahead, just paint.
Hampshire. I bet you looked at Hampshire. Look, quick email from a guy named Bob in Morgantown, West Virginia. You guys inspired a thought in my head this morning about Judith Miller. I think the whole problem with her stance on the leak investigation was that she was simply misunderstood. Everyone thought that she said, I'm protecting the freedom of the press, when she really was saying, I'm protecting the freedom of the prez. Oh, that's clever. That's clever, Bob. So, you know, we were talking about proms, and now that we're talking about high school or college, kind of. Did you go to your senior prom?
Yes.
Did you, was it good?
Oh, that was a good time.
Oh, it was? You had a good time?
Yeah. We went to the plaza. And afterwards, we went to some club, and I had sex on the beach.
Wow. Uh-oh. On the beach?
Yeah.
On a blanket?
A blanket.
Oh, that's good, because it's bad without a blanket on the beach. And how about you, little guy?
Oh, man, mine was so depressing. My junior prom was actually fun.
Let's stick with the depressing one. What happened?
All right, I didn't have a date for that prom.
But you went anyways?
I went anyways. Ooh. I went with my friends...
Yeah,
I know. This kid, Abner and Roberto.
Abner and Roberto and Lil Goliath.
We didn't have a limousine. We had like a sort of a small town car taxi.
And it was the three guys?
It was really sad. Yeah.
Wow, we're going to have to pick this story up tomorrow. For those of you guys who are just tuning in, here are a few highlights of what we talked about on the program. It's time for today's Morning Sedition Cliff Notes. House GOP leaders are moving to cut $50 billion from the budget for things such as, food. Food stamps and health care for the poor. A Republican spokesman said Hurricane Katrina did a lot of damage to poor people, but we realize there is much more to be done, before he remembered to add, to pay for relief efforts. A new study shows the Department of Homeland Security has by far the lowest morale of any government agency. Just 4% said they were sure that creativity and innovation were rewarded, while the remaining 96% thought creativity and innovation were reasons to arrest people. Even more disturbing, the number one reason that employees at Homeland Security Department gave for their low morale was, quote, we're all doomed. An Amish community in Minnesota is split on whether or not to get vaccinations in response to a polio outbreak. Outside communities aren't allowed to rush vaccine into the Amish community unless it's delivered by man in a man in a frock coat riding a crank-driven velocipede. In a compromise position, some Amish are opting for vaccinations as long as they're administered with a cast iron needle. I like that. Phrase of the day, just drop it into conversation. It looks like the Iraqis have approved their constitution. Maybe we've turned the corner in Iraq. Wake up, sheeple. We've turned the corner in Iraq something like four times now. Maybe that's why we're back where we started. What do we got tomorrow there, Riley?
Your guess is as good as mine.
We're going to talk to Cameron Crowe about his new film, Elizabethtown. And we're going to have the Slander Minute.
Lock the gates. Yeah, lock the gates. This is Air America Radio.